You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite having a nearly $700 billion budget for 2011, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta asked Congress this week to suck it up and cut a deficit deal that would spare the Department of Defense from any spending cuts. Just how much money is necessary to keep the DOD and its wide range of contractors in business is one of the many issues that Andrew Feinstein addresses in his latest book, The Shadow World, An Investigation of the Global Arms Trade. Mr. Feinstein is the founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London and an Open Society Institute fellow. His book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased that he was able to join us today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're a former South African MP. Did you deal much with the arms trade when you were in the South African Parliament?
Not initially. When I was elected to Parliament in South Africa's first democratic elections in 1994 as a member of the ANC, I dealt mainly with public financial management. I chaired the committee that drafted a lot of the framework legislation. And it was only after about 6 years that the Financial Oversight Committee, on which I was the ranking ANC member, received a report from the equivalent of the Inspector General about an arms deal that South Africa had entered into, which cost around $10 billion.
This is 1999, and this is around the time that Nelson Mandela is retiring, and we're talking about an arms deal that does involve your party, the ANC.
Absolutely. The arms deal involved buying a whole lot of weaponry that South Africa didn't need and barely uses today. And really, the main justification for the deal was the fact that $300 million in bribes were paid to the defense minister, his political advisor, the head of procurement in the defense force, and, as you say, sadly, to my own party, the ANC.
And what argument were they giving for having to have these arms? There was no threat from Botswana, was there?
I mean, I think there was more of a threat from the penguins off the west coast of Cape Town. The justification was that the Defense Force required modernization, which a public process that I had identified as costing about 8 billion rand. The deal will cost well over 100 billion rand. And when it became clear that there was no meaningful justification for the weapons, the deal was then justified on the basis that it would lead to significant economic investment in the country.
Well, didn't Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund, among other organizations, wind up being implicated in this deal? I was going to say corruption. Yeah.
There was an allegation by an MP, an opposition MP in South Africa, who was the first woman to really blow the whistle on this deal, that checks had gone to, amongst others, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, to a charity run by Mandela's wife, Graça Machel. The veracity of that has never been shown. When I spoke to the Mandela Children's Fund about it, the head of the fund said that it was possible that they received such a check, but he had never been able to trace it.
Who was South Africa buying these arms from?
From a variety of European governments. These were government-to-government deals. So the
United this is Kingdom, legal. This is a legal arms deal, but there is an illegal side to it.
Oh, absolutely, which really is the defining characteristic of this industry. The so-called government-to-government deals, the formal or clean trade, as you suggest, is also wallowing in illegality, usually bribes and corruption. The world's biggest arms deal, a 48 billion British pounds deal with Saudi Arabia, saw 6 billion pounds in commissions being paid. Now, that's effectively bribes.
Commissions are the word that is the word that gets applied to bribe, but people do get commissions for working out deals, don't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You do get occasions in which middlemen or agents in a variety of transactions do get paid for legitimate work. In the arms industry, it tends to be a tiny percentage, sometimes below 1% of the commissions paid, where the majority of the commissions are what are called unauthorized commissions, which are really just going to pay the decision makers. And it's worth mentioning that the arms deal that's been calculated accounts for around 40% of all corruption in all world trade.
40%, that's 40, a lot.
Yeah. It's an extreme amount of
money. Just because so much money is involved.
Absolutely. Well, you have a number of things. You have these deals worth tens of millions of dollars, as was the case in South Africa. Very few people are involved in actually making the final decision. So a few senior politicians and officials, and it all happens behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy.
But there was no national security involved in the situation you start off your book with, the atrocities in Sierra Leone. Why did you start there?
Because that is probably one of the worst exemplars of how the black trade, which is at the opposite end of the continuum of legality that the arms industry constitutes, this was a very typical black trade deal, purely illegal deal, where you had a Ukrainian-Israeli arms dealer ferrying in weapons on his own private plane, which bizarrely was still painted in the colors of the Seattle Sonics basketball team, because that's who he'd bought the plane from. He took these weapons from the Ukraine through Chad into Liberia, where they were then taken in vehicles across the border into Sierra Leone, where the rebel RUF movement was literally waiting for these weapons. And we've been able to document how these particular shipments led to the most brutal of the battles in the Sierra Leonean civil war. So it is just, I suppose, such an exemplar of how the industry operates, because in return, this dealer, Leonid Minin, was extracting huge quantities of what became known as blood diamonds from Sierra Leone.
Couldn't he just as easily have been selling to the Sierra Leonean government?
Well, no, because the rebels were actually in conflict with the Sierra Leonean government. Charles Taylor was really the man. He was the dictator of Liberia, mm-hmm. and he was the man behind the
rebel
movement.
I'm just saying that sometimes these arms dealers sell to outside.
Absolutely, absolutely. In this case, the Sierra Leonean government had very few weapons. And Minin, in a variety of other transactions, sold to all sides in conflict.
And where did these weapons come from?
All over the place. There was a huge stockpile of weaponry in place when the Soviet Union broke apart at the end of the Cold War. So there was a massive increase in black market dealing in weaponry. But today they come from all sorts of places. There are weapons on the black market today that come from Libya, for instance. And they're now sourced from all over the world.
And the United States manufactures a fair amount of them.
Well, the United States is the biggest producer and trader of weapons, producing almost as much weaponry as the rest of the world combined.
Now, President Eisenhower warned about the growing power of the military-industrial complex, but you've added the word congressional into the mix, the military-industrial-congressional complex.
Well, I didn't. Eisenhower did in the original draft of his speech.
Said congressional as well?
According to his daughter, and he then took the word congressional out because he felt that even as a former president, he needed to retain good relations with Congress.
But Congress does play a key role in all of this, doesn't it? If somebody wants to cut funding for some arms program, the local congressman goes screaming bloody murder. The congressman who represents the district where that will be manufactured. Somebody like Murtha, really, he was very effective in that sort of thing, wasn't he, John Murtha?
Absolutely. The late John Murtha, who chaired the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee on Capitol Hill, was regarded as the king of pork. He would ensure that to get his support for pretty much any legislation, whether it was defense-related or not, in Congress, there would have to be monies transferred to his congressional district. And he had an airport that was used as an Air Force base built. He had an enormous amount of contracts going to small defense contractors in his district.
There's a cliche image of the archetypical gunrunner who's an allegianless international cosmopolitan. Where does that come from? Is that a true picture?
Yeah, it actually is. I mean, a lot of the arms dealers I've interviewed, and obviously a lot of them didn't want to talk to me, but amongst those who did, they tended to have had a fairly rootless upbringing. And that carried over into their activities. They're very happy to move to wherever the most money is to be made.
Well, the probably the most famous one today is it Victor Bout? Victor Bout, I never...
Bout, yeah.
He just recently was convicted of arms trafficking, but does he fit the stereotype?
Oh, yes, he certainly does. I mean, he became the sort of the poster boy, almost by default. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of Victor Bouts. And the interesting thing about Bout is not only that he sold weapons virtually everywhere on the planet, especially where there were UN arms embargoes, because he could charge a premium on those weapons, which is what arms dealers do. He often armed both sides in conflicts. And interestingly, between 2003 and 2005, did a lot of work for the U.S. Department of Defense in Iraq.
My guest is Andrew Feinstein, whose book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. How far back does this go? Did this begin in the 19th century, or did it begin with people like Basil Zaharoff?
The modern arms trade, as we understand it, and the modern arms dealer really originated with Zaharoff. And at the time of lots of increases in industrialization, in the production of weaponry. And Zaharoff was this fascinating character. As far as we can ascertain, he was Greek-born, went into the industry very early, sold first to the Greeks and then to their sworn enemy, the Turks, and that was something he practiced throughout his career, and was really known as the person who would meet with a minister and quite literally leave a brown bag of gold coins on the table. So he is the archetypal, the template for modern arms dealers.
But he had to have been able to buy his arms from somebody else. There were no big arms manufacturers in Greece or Turkey at the time. So is he pretty much buying from the Americans and the British?
Absolutely. Zaharoff in particular bought primarily from the British, who were the world's largest industrial power in the late 1800s when he really started out in the industry. And he's regarded as the godfather of the modern BAE Systems, which is one of the three biggest defense contractors in the world, a British company that's been involved in a whole range of corrupt activities. But the great thing about Zaharoff is not only that he sold to all sides, he also befriended very senior politicians. He was a confidant of the British Prime Minister Lloyd George, and he persuaded George that it was actually a good thing that in the lead-up to the First World War, he, Zaharoff, was supplying the Prussians, the Germans, as well as the British, because he claimed he could get vital intelligence for the British.
Well, you make the case that large British and American firms made up the formal trade in arms, but a small German company represented the depths of the shadow world that you're writing about. What was that company?
This was a company called Merex that was formed in the wake of the Second World War by a small group of former senior Nazi officers. And their early deals were facilitated with help from German intelligence and American intelligence in the early days of the Cold War.
So they were seen as part of the fight in the Cold War. They were enlisted to fight the Soviet Union and all of its satellites.
Absolutely. These were seen as Nazis who could be useful to the emerging Western alliance that was taking on the Soviet Union. But, of course, like all arms dealers, Gerhard Mertens, the founder, there were people like Klaus Barbie, who was for a while a director of the company. This is the man known as the Butcher of Lyon, did a lot of their work in South America with people like Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean dictator, and others. But like all arms dealers, Gerhard Mertens, the founder, tried to play both sides of every conflict and got himself into a lot of trouble doing that, but again was often protected by the intelligence agencies with which he worked.
What was the Gehlen Org?
The Gehlen Org was a very interesting entity that was named after one of these senior Nazis who the Allies identified very soon after the fall of Nazi Germany that they would be very useful to the West during the Cold War, and therefore their pasts were conveniently forgotten, and they were recruited to work with American intelligence primarily. And Gerhard Mertens was a part of this Gehlen Org.
Andrew Feinstein's book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Andrew Feinstein, who is currently an Open Society Institute Fellow, founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London. His latest book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Isn't much of the arms trade legal, totally on the up and up, the sort of thing that countries like the United States engage in with Saudi Arabia or Israel or Egypt or some of the other countries that we sell to?
It's certainly regarded as legal, but the reality is that in 11 years of researching this trade, I have yet to come across a deal conducted government to government that does not have elements of illegality involved in it. So, for instance, deals with Saudi Arabia are notorious for paying, as I mentioned earlier, massive amounts of commission. And it's accepted that unless those are paid, the deals don't happen.
Some of the argument that we hear in Congress is that military spending is important for job creation. What are the statistics prove in that regard?
Well, there are two things. There is no doubt that the industry, not only in the U.S. but globally, does create a lot of jobs. I think that the numbers are often overstated by the companies themselves. For instance, when an inquiry into the very corrupt Saudi deal with the U.K. was being investigated, the U.K. company and government claimed that 55,000 jobs were in jeopardy if an investigation went ahead because the Saudis were refusing to buy a new jet fighter. And when we did a little closer analysis of it, it turned out that between 5 and 10,000 of those jobs were actually in the UK. The rest had already been moved to various parts of Eastern Europe. And in the US, I think the very interesting thing is that you must understand that these companies benefit from huge government subsidies, public money, mainly for research and development and various other aspects of what they do, so that these jobs are heavily subsidized. And it's been calculated by a group of economists in the US that for the cost of each job in the defense sector, it would be possible to create between 3 and 7 jobs in most other manufacturing sectors.
How long has this been going on? Is this going back to the end of World War II?
Well, yeah, in its current form, I think what happened was the military-industrial complex was really consolidated during World War II when the relationships between the defense contractors, governments, and the military became incredibly close, understandably, and I don't think they've ever moved beyond that, really. And then I think the other thing that has changed is the national security discourse has evolved over the decades. It has become more secretive. And I think post the 9/11 tragedy, particularly, it has become very difficult to question anything that falls under the domain of national security, even if there is massive wastage taking place in weapons projects that are perhaps unnecessary.
The U.S. government supported Hosni Mubarak's regime with different types of aid. How much of it was in military
From 1981, when Mubarak took power in Egypt, until his recent overthrow, the U.S. sold Egypt just over $21 billion of weapons. Most of that would have been in the form of aid that was then in turn used to buy weapons from American companies.
To some degree, wasn't that also in payment for Egypt's support of continued support of the peace agreement it had with Israel?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that arms and the arms trade is used as a tool of geopolitics, of foreign policy. My contention is that that doesn't mean that it has to be a deeply corrupt, unaccountable industry. For instance, in the case of Mubarak, from the time he was head of the Egyptian Air Force, and especially when he was the country's president, he made literally hundreds of millions of dollars out of these arms deals with the United States because on every deal he himself took a substantial cut.
You mentioned, you've talked a bit about the British deal with Saudi Arabia. What would have happened if the Saudis had decided to buy French jets instead of British jets?
Well, the reality is that that's not the way it works. This isn't an openly competitive environment. What happened in what is the world's biggest arms deal, what was called the Yamamah deal, and ironically, after it was shown that Mark Thatcher, the son of Margaret Thatcher, the British Prime Minister at the time of the deal, had received £12 million as an agent on the deal, some people referred to it as Who's Yamamah rather than Al Yamamah. But the crucial thing about that Saudi deal was that the US actually wanted to supply that weaponry. This was in the 1980s. But the Israel lobby in Congress persuaded enough elected representatives that selling very advanced weapons to Saudi could constitute a threat to the state of Israel, as a consequence of which President Reagan at the time effectively handed the deal over to Margaret Thatcher, who then negotiated with the then Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, whose father happened to be the Saudi defense minister at the time. So it wasn't really a matter of open competition, even though they went through some of the posturing of open competition.
But the deal has been investigated by several different international fraud authorities, hasn't it?
Well, the UK's Serious Fraud Office conducted a 5.5-year investigation into this particular deal, the incredibly complex offshore financial mazes through which these bribes were paid. And as they were about to lay charges against the chairman and chief executive of BAE Systems, the administration of then Prime Minister Tony Blair intervened to close down the investigation.
So all of these things cut across all administrations. Whatever party's in power, this thing seems to go on.
Oh, the political stripe of those in power is almost irrelevant. Just as the Democrats are as supportive as the Republicans in the United States, Labour are as supportive as the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom. It is almost a function of the state to have these very close relationships with arms companies that lead to what is a secretive trade that is fertile territory for bribery and corruption.
My guest is Andrew Feinstein, whose latest book is The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can some of these arms deals come back to haunt us, like in Afghanistan, the blowback from Charlie Wilson's war?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is probably the most notorious case of blowback, or the unintended consequences of arms transactions, where the late Congressman Charlie Wilson ensured that the CIA, through its black operations budget, which is never publicly approved, exponentially increased the amount of weaponry that they were giving to the Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. But even as the Soviet occupation was drawing to an end, there were clear reports that many of the Mujahideen leaders who Wilson and the U.S. had been supplying had become very militant in their outlook, very anti-American in their outlook. But Wilson continued to ensure that the weapons flowed. And his biographer talks in a very poignant passage of, after the 9/11 tragedy, Wilson drinking himself into a stupor because, in his own words, whenever he was sober, he had to confront the reality that this had happened, as he put it, in my mountains, with my Muj, because the Mujahideen ultimately turned into the Taliban.
And they wound up using those weapons against U.S. troops. But he said of the Afghan defeat of the Soviets, it was glorious and changed the world, and then we bleeped up the end game. So he's not taking responsibility. He's just saying after the Soviets were forced out of Afghanistan, the United States abandoned Afghanistan, and we wound up paying a price.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that it's just about abandoning Afghanistan. I think the most crucial component of it is the continued provision for a number of years after there were a lot of reports about the nature of some of the people who were being supported, and providing them with highly sophisticated weaponry. And these people, once they had effectively defeated one superpower, were not averse to going after the only remaining superpower.
What about a blowback as a result of the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya?
Well, the extraordinary irony of the Libyan case is that when NATO started its bombing raids in support of the rebel movement that was looking to overthrow Gaddafi, the first thing they had to do was actually destroy an enormous amount of weaponry that had been sold to Gaddafi by the NATO member states themselves, so the European Union countries, the United States, and to a lesser degree, Russia in later years. And a lot of that equipment, because Gaddafi was sold more equipment than he could actually have manned. He just didn't have the military personnel for it all. A lot of it was stored in warehouses that were not particularly well guarded or looked after. And as the transition started to unfold in Libya, so these warehouses were effectively abandoned. And we're already seeing quite a lot of those weapons that were sold to Gaddafi appearing on the world's black market in weapons, so that anybody who has a spare $50,000 can effectively buy themselves an old surface-to-air missile that can take down a commercial passenger jet.
But doesn't all weapons and intelligence technology eventually change hands regardless of ideology?
Well, it does. I mean, the so-called black and gray trades do tend to ensure that these weapons have a much longer life than they ordinarily would, and that they will land up in the hands of the very people they were meant to wage conflict against.
Well, is it possible for weapons to be better accounted for and disposed of?
Oh, absolutely. And there are two things that would need to be done to ensure that the trade took place in a way that lessened the unintended consequences. The first is far greater transparency on the use of middlemen, because what happens with those middlemen through whom the bribes are paid, et cetera, is they also siphon off quite a lot of the weaponry that is being used in these deals and can therefore sell to others outside of the formal deal that they're involved in. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if so many of these deals didn't have an element of subterfuge in them, it would be far easier to continually track these weapons and ensure that they didn't land up in the wrong hands. But you can only do that if you are conducting these deals in a transparent and accountable manner.
Can you tell us about the dismantling plant at Gerdek?
Well,
This is a small town, isn't it? And a lot of ammunition winds up there?
This is a very small village just outside Tirana, the capital of Albania in Eastern Europe. A 21-year-old American from Miami Beach, Florida, a chap called Ephraim Divaroli, was awarded a $300 million contract by the U.S. Department of Defense to supply the Afghan security forces with most of their ammunition needs. This is despite the fact that at the age of 21, he was already on a State Department arms trading watch list. Being a fairly clever chap, he identified where he could get this ammunition cheapest, and it happened to be Albania, where there was 40-year-old Chinese ammunition stockpiled. He went to Albania. He did a deal with some very dodgy business people in Albania, with the head of the Arms Export and Import State Agency, and with the Defense Minister of Albania himself. So they together built a very flimsy factory in the middle of this village, because it happened to be near the Tirana International Airport. And the army, at its expense in Albania, started to bring this ammunition from all over the country to the factory at Gerdet. And in 2008, because there were no safety standards, there are pictures of empty shells with TNT and gunpowder still in them, simply being bulldozed onto an adjoining field. And unsurprisingly, in 2008, the factory exploded, killing 26 entirely innocent people, including three generations of the family who happened to live in a house next to the factory, and also a 7-year-old boy who happened to be cycling past the factory at the wrong moment.
In this country, we feel that there is competition between companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin. Is there fair competition?
I would suggest that it's what I describe as manufactured competition. And what I mean by that is senior officials in the Pentagon will decide on the weapons they want. And therefore, together with the producer who has been enticing them to buy these weapons, the defense contractor, they will then go to Congress almost as one to seek approval.
But hasn't the Department of Defense stepped up its activity against corruption in the arms sector in recent years? And the Obama administration promised to bring meaningful reform to the procurement process.
I think two separate points need to be made here. The first is that in relation to international export deals, the U.S. has certainly become better than it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when it was U.S. defense contractors who were undertaking a vast amount of the corruption that was taking place in the global arms trade. But because of the strengthening of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the US and its enforcement, that activity has definitely been curtailed quite significantly. It still goes on, but not nearly of the order that it used to. However, the domestic circle of patronage that I described is, to my mind, another form of bribery. However, in the United States, it happens to be legal bribery.
Well, where is the UN in all of this? The 2008 UN General Assembly issued a report toward an arms trade treaty and notes that weapons being traded on the illicit market most often started out as legally traded weapons. Is the UN doing anything to stop the illicit part of the trade?
The UN is currently negotiating, as you mentioned, an international arms trade treaty. The huge issue there is whether this is simply going to be a very weak treaty that countries like China and Russia, who don't want the trade in weapons regulated any more than it is at the moment, would support. And that would be a treaty that would ostensibly provide a stamp of approval to the status quo in arms trading as it currently is. What I would like to see, and what a number of other organizations would like to see, is a really tough arms trade treaty that changes the playing field on which arms are traded so that there is greater transparency, there are strong anti-corruption measures in place, and they are enforced.
Isn't one of the problems with UN treaties that not everybody signs the treaty, and so it doesn't really matter? The worst offenders will continue doing what they do?
Absolutely. But my contention in that regard is that it is better to set the bar high and to try and compel others to sign on rather than to set the bar so low that it has no practical impact on the trade that is carrying on today. So if we can get a treaty that is fairly strong, it is going to compel even those who might not sign up initially to start changing the way they behave. And most importantly, if the United States, which so dominates the trade in weapons, changes the way in which it operates, a lot of people are going to have to fall in line beside it.
Andrew Feinstein's book is The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He is the a founding co-director of the Corruption Watch in London and also an Open Society Institute fellow. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for your time.